impetus to juggle competing imperatives, to at the same time challenge and critique conventional norms, conceptions, and values, while at the same time remaining engaged and living in the world. So this is reflected in how the Buddha taught. First off, he used reductionist arguments and non-Brahmanical language, Prakrit language, to challenge and oftentimes mock Vedic sacrifices and authority. He critiqued both the esoteric householder practices and esoteric forest pursuits. He associated both of these pursuits, the path of the householder, the path of the forest, with tanha, or trishna in Sanskrit, that is a kind of problematic desire. Both paths, the Buddha's teaching suggests, thirst after, anticipate, pursue, abstractions, things that are not present. Instead, the Buddha advised mindful attention to phenomenal processes, specifically five interdependent keys of momentary actions and reactions, and contended that these five interdependent keys of phenomenal processes make abstract objects like selves, one might think like varna, seem stable and present. So instead of encouraging obeisance to conventional norms and mores, obeisance to Vedic norms and categories, the Buddha specifically advised cultivating habits of specific and lucid thinking, speaking, and doing through his call for us to practice the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, so again, this was about 5th century, 4th century before the Common Era. Now, early Buddhist elaborations of his teachings, the term early is a little ridiculous, because we're talking about 900 years here, right? So early Buddhist elaborations, first you have Abhidharma, who ran with and emphasized the reductionist aspect of Buddhist teaching, specifically by arguing for the reduction of seemingly enduring objects to discrete elemental kinds of phenomena, dhammas, likely with a focus on meditative practice. Abhidharma, that was about the 3rd century BCE. And then in about the 2nd or 1st century BCE, you have the rise of the Sarvastivadins. They asserted the ontological reality of the dhammas. So again, this emphasis on the reduction. And remember, reduction was a tool of critiquing prevailing norms, concepts, and categories. Now, after the Abhidharma and the Sarvastivadins, you find the rise of Madhyamaka. And specifically, the Madhyamaka folks are critiquing. It's an internal critique of Buddhist interpretation. Specifically, the charge is that these Abhidharma and Sarvastivadins were creating new dogmas. They were establishing new norms, practices, concepts that were deserving of critique. Or they were utterly, or they were impractical. So Madhyamaka, specifically Nagarjuna, came onto the scene. He argued against essentialism, the kind of essentialism that the Sarvastivadins encouraged. He argued against reductionism, which, as I've suggested, was present within the Pali Canon, the Buddhist teachings from quite early stage, and was a tool of critique. Instead, he advocated. I hesitate to use the term advocated, but he advocated for shunyata, the zeroness, the nullness, the nothingness of all species and positions. So his contention was that attachment to species is itself a form of tanha, of problematic desire, of thirsting. And then the last school I'm going to bring up is the Yogacara school. And this is before I move directly into the philosophy of language debate, so you have a some notion of the philosophical context that these folks are working within. The Yogacara folks came onto the scene in about the 4th or 5th century CE, right? Now that I'm 900 years now after the Buddha. The Yogacara, and specifically Vasubandhu, used chitta matra, consciousness-only, representation-only thesis, to challenge conventional conceptions and to redirect attention to momentary phenomena. So despite the Madhyamaka critique, you still have this recurring move within Buddhist text tradition back to reduction of species, back to attending to the phenomena that constitute experience and cautioning against attention to seemingly enduring conventional truth. Does this all make sense? Okay, so that was an absurdly brief introduction to Buddhist philosophy. And now I'm going to continue on to an absurdly brief introduction to Buddhist philosophy of language. Right? Specifically, I want us to turn to Dinyaga. Dinyaga was one of the first people within Buddhist folks within the tradition of pramana theory. Pramana is a term for knowledge, instruments of knowledge in Sanskrit. And so folks like Dinyaga were exploring what are the proper causes or instruments of knowing. How is it that people come to know things? Right now, Dinyaga was a student of Yogacara. He appears to have been significantly influenced by Vasubandhu. And he worked to challenge Vedic authority quite specifically. And he did so by questioning how and what people can know through words. Now, the question of knowledge through words was a direct challenge to Vedic knowledge claims, because the Vedas are words. Vedic knowledge is shruti. Vedic knowledge is heard. So by critiquing how it is that people know through words, Dinyaga is specifically continuing the Buddhist tradition of critiquing prevailing Vedic knowledge claims. The Vedas cannot be a distinct way of knowing, because it's knowing through words is problematic, right? And it's in this context that issues of ineffability within the Pramana tradition and within Buddhist philosophy of language kind of start coming into the scene. So the first thing that Dinyaga did was he introduced a distinction between real phenomena and fake objects. He asserted a distinction between cognition of unique momentary phenomena, swalakshanas, these things here, right? And cognition of generic enduring objects, samanya lakshana. The term lakshana literally means characteristic. Swa gives you the sense of uniqueness, right? Samanya you can interpret as generic or universal, right? So characteristically unique, characteristically generic. Now, Dinyaga's claim was that there's ultimately only one way that people know anything, and that's through sensing, perception, pratyaksha. And he argued that sensing, in a way that a lot of empiricists would agree, is always sensing of a specific, vivid, momentary sensa, stuff that's sensed. Right. So within Dinyaga's claim, within Dinyaga's system, he contended that real knowing, pratyaksha, is sensing. It's a unitary, undivided cognition. There's an immediate grasp of a vivid, unique, real, momentary particular. He argued in contrast that other forms of quote-unquote knowing weren't really knowing. They were a kind of conventional truth. They were knowing in a kind of scare-quotey way, right? Furthermore, he said that in terms of conventional knowing, there's only one other type. You've got real knowing, which is pratyaksha, immediate direct sensing of unique, vivid, momentary particulars. And then you've got knowing through inference, which is anumana. Knowing through inference is always twofold. You have a momentary particular that's brought to sensation, that's immediately grasped in sensation, and then on the basis of that momentary particular, you come to know of something else that is not present to your cognition. So the paradigmatic case of inference in a lot of Sanskrit texts within this tradition is knowing fire on the basis of smoke, right? So you look over on a hill, you see smoke coming up from it. That's an immediate grasp of a direct, real sense particular. And then on the basis of that provocation, of that sign, you infer a signified object. You infer something that is not present, fire, right? Now the cognitions are different. When we infer, say, a fire on a distant hill, that's different from seeing fire. If you see fire, it's blazing, it's red, the heat strikes you, it's a vivid experience. But when you infer fire, the fire that you come to realize is quite different from that. It's generic, it's dull, it seems to endure across time, where fire is constantly changing. Right. So stuff that provokes an inferential cognition is always a swalakshana, a unique, momentary, vivid particular. And stuff that we come to know through inference, the inferred object, is always a samanyalakshana, enduring, generic, dull. Now, Dunyaga's major intervention and the focus of his critique or his means of challenging Vedic authority was to contend that knowing through words is always inferential. So when we know through words, it operates basically the same as coming to know a fire on a distant hill through the presence of smoke. I say the words of fire, you are provoked, your ears immediately grasp the syllables, the sounds that my mouth produces. That immediate, vivid, particular, momentary presentation then provokes you, based on your past, your upbringing, to come to, quote-unquote, know of a fire. Right? So if I'm in this room right now, I yell fire, you will come to know of a fire on the base of inference. But the fire that you come to know isn't going to be a real fire. The fire that you come to know is, unlike real fire, going to be opaque, dull, generic. It's a fictional object. So this theory of verbal, quote-unquote, knowing as inference is one that kind of fits in nicely with a bunch of different Yogacara tendencies within Buddhism. What's ultimately true? Phenomenal particulars. Real, unique, vivid particulars. What kinds of things aren't true, or at best are only conventional real, enduring objects. Things that we come to know through words. Things like the varnas, the fourfold system of human classification. Things like the Atman, the self, Brahman. These are cartoons. They're not real phenomena. It also fits in with the distinction that was beginning to emerge between conventional truth, right, just think truth with scare quotes around it, and ultimate truth. Now, I love Dunyaga's arguments against knowledge of things through words, and I've got slides here summarizing them, but just for the sake of time, I don't want to jump straight into those arguments, but I have left them on the presentation toward the end, and if we've got enough time, we can go back and look at them. What I want to focus on with Dunyaga is a different way of how he kind of explicated verbal knowing. He argued that knowing through words is a kind of inference, but the way that the kind of direct object is known is through processes of exclusion. So what do we know when we know through words from the perspective of ultimate truth? Nothing. What do we know through words such as varna? Nothing. What do we know through words such as gender? Nothing. What do we know through words such as conventional truth? Nothing. Words work instead through exclusion of the other, a term that the Sanskrit term is anya apoha. Apoha means exclusion, anya means other. So exclusion of the other. When I cognize a pot, there's not a specific pot that's brought to mind. All that I'm cognizing, the way the inference is working, is through assumptions, practices, reflexes, phenomenal processes associated with what is non-pot. What happens when I infer a cow? Well, I make a lot of assumptions, cognitively, practically, about what fails to qualify as a cow. And it's these practices of exclusion of the other, exclusion of other words within Dunyaga, that gives us the illusion of coming to know objects through words inferentially. So within Dunyaga's theory of meaning, knowledge from words is at best conventional, always inferential, and this is a direct challenge to text traditions which claim special direct knowledge from the Vedas, true. Turkey. All right, also there are implicit ineffabilities in Dinyaga's exclusion theory of meaning. And these are theories, these are ineffabilities that the person I do want to focus on today, Jnanasri Mitra, really picks up and runs with in his text, the monograph on exclusion, the Apoha Prakaranam. So where are the ineffabilities within Jnanasri's theory of verbal knowing? Well, the Swalakshanas can't be expressed through words. They're beyond words. Why? Well, because objects of words are, like those of inference, always generic, samanya lakshana. So you can't use words to come to know swalakshanas. You only know swalakshanas through direct sensing. Now, why can't samanya lakshanas be expressed through words? Well, they're never present to thought. So we only know samanya lakshanas by enacting certain practices of exclusion. So therefore, as Jnanasri Mitra later claims, words express nothing whatsoever. So according to Dinyaga, we know objects at best conventionally through practices of exclusion. Ultimately, all knowledge is immediate sensing of unique momentary particulars. Objects are anticipated fiction. So Dinyaga, you might say, directs attention in quintessentially Buddhist fashion. From the pursuit, grasping, thirsting after things, atman, dharma, to phenomenal processes that constitute lived experience, including practices of exclusion. And I think it's interesting to consider whether practices of whether the practices of the Eightfold Noble Path counteract some of these practices of exclusion. Okay, the next thing I want to move into, I mentioned that Madhyamaka criticized reductionist tendencies within Buddhism, and clearly Dinyaga has reductionist tendencies. So I want to look at Madhyamaka Buddhist criticisms of Dinyaga's Pramana project, and it's here that we're going to start seeing appeals to conventional truth emerge in a normative way. That is, in a way where conventional truth is supposed to have some clout. Okay, so recall that about two centuries earlier, Nagarjuna had argued against essentialism, reductionism, and other theses. He'd contended that attachment to theses is a form of tanha, problematic desire, and he argued for emptiness as the default position after all theses have been abandoned, zero-ness. Now, Dinyaga's Pramana program struck contemporary Madhyamaka Buddhists as another instance of Buddhist reductionism and thirsting after theses. Chandrakirti appears specifically, and he's a 7th century Madhyamaka philosopher, to have critiqued Dinyaga's Pramana theory directly. So I want to turn briefly to Chandrakirti's criticisms of Dinyaga and his advocation of advocacy of conventional truth and conventional practice as normative categories. Okay, so here are some of Chandrakirti's criticisms of this Poha theory of meaning elaborated by Dinyaga and then developed by subsequent Buddhists, most notably Dharmakirti. What Dinyaga calls perception, Chandrakirti appears to argue, is nothing like what people in and of the world think of as perception. What people in and of the world consider perception actions such as seeing enduring objects, seeing people, cows, pots. We're not aware of perception. We don't use perception colloquially in the world, in our vernacular, to talk about immediate direct sensing of vivid, ineffable particulars. Right? So what do ordinary people think, people in and of the world think? Well, we think that we can see things like chairs. We think that we can see cows. Right? We're not aware of these inferential processes taking place. And what Dinyaga is proposing is a radically different understanding of perception. And for what reason? Right? According to Chandrakirti, Dinyaga uses swalakshana in a weird way, too. Swalakshana is these unique momentary particulars. Well, if you look at Sanskrit grammar, swalakshana, that's a characteristic that's unique. It's supposed to be an adjective. It's not supposed to be an object. And Dinyaga is offering this kind of weirdly specialized, theoretical, arcane use of swalakshana. And again, for what purpose? What is achieved by this kind of high theory at the expense of conventional practice? And so Chandrakirti specifically asks, what's gained by this pramana theory? What is expressible knowledge doesn't count as knowledge. It's always knowledge, now in Vinyasa's theory. True knowledge, what truly counts as knowledge, is utterly beyond words and inexpressible. And now only unique momentary particulars are real, and people, chairs, cows, pots are unreal. Chandrakirti asks, why in the world replace views and practices of folk in and of the world with these, also imperfect, because they're expressed through words, but also utterly impracticable views and practices? According to Chandrakirti, we'd be better off sticking to the views, the truths, and practices of people in of the world. And so he appealed to notions of loka samvritta satya and loka via vihara. Let me explain these terms really briefly. The notion of loka is actually kind of difficult to explain and read because it signifies both people and world. So I've been using this weird phrase, people in of the world, to signify loka. Via vihara means practices, but it also in Sanskrit has a connotation of agreements, specifically legal agreements, right? So the agreements, the practices, the norms of people in and of the world. Loka Samvriti Satya, again, the same clause, loka, people, world, but we've got satya, which means truth, also means reality, existence. But what kind of truth is this is an open question because it's qualified by samvriti. And in Sanskrit, samvriti means concealed, covered, right? So it's a kind of benighted truth. It's a kind of ignorant truth, a concealing, imperfect truth. So what Chandrakirti is advocating is sticking with the benighted views of folk in and of the world. Now, my definition or my proposed way to think about philosophy as this effort to navigate between kind of two binds, two imperatives. On the one hand, we're looking for means, ways of critiquing prevailing conventional concepts, norms, practices, categories. On the other hand, we're looking for ways to critique that allow us to stay engaged with and living within the world. If you think of Chandrakirti's criticisms of Vinyasa and of these pramana projects themselves, he's basically accusing Vinyasa of going back and falling too much into the second pitfall, the path of renunciation, nihilist path that we need to avoid. So Chandrakirti is essentially saying that Vinyasa has fallen into a kind of renunciation of the world. His views, his philosophy of language is utterly impracticable. But he responds, Chandrakirti responds, by espousing loka samvriti satya. That is the normativity, apparent normativity, of the views, practices, and people in the world. So the question still remains, how is this middle way going in philosophy of language going to navigate between these two competing imperatives? You could think of Chandrakirti aligning himself with conventional truth, and perhaps Vinyasa on Chandrakirti's, perhaps on charitable reading, aligning himself with the escapist, nihilistic path. Okay, now all this is kind of precursor, fortunately, right? All of this is background text for us to jump in and look at Jnanasri Mitra and his philosophy, with his philosophy of language in particular. Jnanasri Mitra came relatively late within the philosophical tradition in India with Buddhism. So he's an 11th century Buddhist philosopher. He was one of the last in the Pramana tradition. He was influenced by Buddhist philosophies of language, Vinyasa, but even more so Dharmakirti. But he was also very much influenced and aware of Chandrakirti's and others' appeals to conventional truth. So the central thesis of his monograph on exclusion is that all things, dharmas, are inexpressible. And he supports this universal ineffability thesis by arguing that exclusion is what is revealed by words and inferential reasons. Right? So he's building on the Apoha tradition. I just want to pause and entertain or recognize the apparent absurdity of this thesis. Words express nothing whatsoever. Here I am talking to you, right? And I'm going to explain why words express nothing whatsoever. Apoha theorists felt similarly appalled by this thesis, felt that it was similarly ridiculous. Now, Jnanasri Mitra, that's the first statement in his Apoha Prakaranam, his statement of his thesis, is that words express nothing whatsoever. And he explains that he's going to justify this thesis by arguing, showing that exclusion alone is what is revealed by words and inferential reasons. Now, like his predecessors, he accepts and builds on notions of conventional truth, locus invertit satya. Specifically, he says that conventional truth can warrant what he calls conditionally adopted positions, via vastas. Now, in the same way that ineffability, universal ineffability has seemed pretty ridiculous to some, Jnanasri Mitra's appeal to these conditionally adopted positions has also seemed pretty ridiculous. So his translator, a contemporary philosopher of Buddhism and Jnanasri Mitra, but Indian philosophy in general, Paramel Patel, he says that these conditionally adopted positions function as, quote, white lies. Okay. So are apoha and appeals to these viavastas just merely clever yet obviously dubious rhetorical devices? And that's something that I want us to consider, and I want to suggest that actually Jnanasri Mitra is doing something highly original here. Right. So first off, Jnanasri Mitra advocates four apparently contrary theses about reference. He also argues for four apparently contrary theses about the place of apoha, exclusion, within meaning. And all of these four contrary theses are conditionally adopted positions. So I want to show or suggest that this concept of viavastas enables a distinct style of dialectical philosophizing that allows him to both acknowledge that conventional truths have some kind of normativity, while also facilitating showing how exclusion features within the determination, the understanding of words. That is, he advocates a style of philosophizing that allows us to both critique conditionally or conventional truths, conditionally adopted positions, and at the same time acknowledge in context the normativity. So let me just say a little bit about Jnanasri Mitra's conditionally adopted positions, and then we'll move into his theses and how his philosophizing works. So viavastas are warranted, according to Jnanasri Mitra, by conventional or ultimate truth. Conventional truth consists in the understandings, this is me quoting the translation of Jnanasri Mitra, consists in the understanding of ordinary people. And he's using the same phrase, a folk in of the world. Right? And he, according to Jnanasri Mitra, conventional truth is the universally accepted basis for action and inaction. So it's only through conventional truth that we are able to act at all in the world. Now, by the standard of ultimate truth, what is really the case, viavastas are always false. Yet a conditionally adopted position can be warranted by ultimate truth if, relative to what is, quote unquote, really the case, it is somehow less benighted or ignorant, some bricky-ish, than another position. Specifically, he says, he appeals to the notion of the cessation of the thirst that propels an inquiry or an action. So a relatively less benighted position will be one that seizes the thirst that motivates an action to take place within the conventional realm. So rather than a dichotomy between ultimate truth and conventional truth, we have ultimate truth, which is inexpressible and provides no apparent basis for practical action. And then we have various orders of conventional truth, distinguished by their degrees of practical efficacy. Okay, so now I want to turn to his mode of philosophizing. And it's really, I mean, I don't know if you have the same sense of humor as I do, but this is an absolutely hilarious text to read, right? Because the way that the way that Jnanasri Mitra sets up his the rhetoric of his argument is it's slippery. It's rhetorically tremendously slippery because he's appealing to these conditionally adopted positions. So he starts off like guns all ablaze, like, you know, asserting his thesis. Words express nothing whatsoever, and he's going to show this by saying that they only operate through exclusion of the other. Now, the purvapaksha, the dialectical opponent within Sanskrit philosophies, immediately trashes this thesis. Points out, you know, 600 years of objections to a poha theory, right, in this extremely crisp, precise order. And Jnanasri Mitra responds not by defending his universal ineffability thesis directly, but apparently by just giving it up. Okay, you got me. Okay, what I really mean to say, he says, is that words primarily express external objects rather than mental images. Now, what does he mean by mental images? Well, he means the images, the notions, you might think of stereotypes, right, that pop into your head as soon as you hear a word, right? It's nobody thinks that these stereotypes, these images, these vikalpas are really what words signify. Rather, we know that when somebody says fire, they don't mean the fire that pops imaginatively into the back of your head. They mean the fire that's over there burning things up, right? Now, the purvapaksha, the dialectical opponent, doesn't think that words express mental images. In fact, the purvapaksha's position is precisely this first conventional truth, this conditionally adopted position that Jnanasri Mitra advocates. Words primarily express external objects. And there's a sense of relief in the purvapaksha in the text, like, oh, that's what you mean. Well, that's fine, right? Jnanasri Mitra then moves from there and progressively walks the opponent to his apparently more quite radical and apparently universal thesis. So the first thing that he says is, after arguing, showing, agreeing that words primarily express external objects, Jnanasri Mitra then argues against the position he had just agreed to, and says instead, well, what he really means is that words express objects as grounds for determination. Now, determination is a term of art within Jnanasri Mitra's work. Essentially, they're talking about the ways of figuring out what the objects that we're talking about. Right, so remember, verbal knowing is always inferential. You've got the immediate provocation, which is always unique and particular, and then you've got the external object. Right, determination is the way that that external object is figured out or inferred. Right, and according to Jnanasri Mitra and the poha theorists in general, this determination works through practices of exclusion of the other. So now what Jnanasri Mitra proceeds to argue is that words express objects not directly, but rather as grounds for determining, to figuring out the object. Right, so when I say fire, you don't come to know fire. You come to know a way of getting to fire, approaching fire. When I say the way to the airport is such and such, I'm not presenting you the airport. I'm presenting you as a way of getting to the airport. Right? That's what's expressed through words. The purvapaksha, the dialectical opponent, agrees with this, and then proceeds on to. Jnanasri Mitra then proceeds on to his next conditionally adopted position about reference. What he really means isn't just that words express objects as grounds for determination, but really if you dig in a little bit deeper, you see that what words express are objects on the basis of an appearance. So what happens, we don't just have grounds for determination, but when I say a word such as fire, what happens is you have a vikalpa, you have an image of fire that pops into your head. This positive image. Now, this positive image is an amalgamation of all various properties of fires based on your karmic history, the history of your actions and your upbringing. Right. So when I say cow, you immediately have a positive image of cow. But the positive image that you have is unlike any cow that actually exists. This is like a cartoon cow. This cow is an amalgamation of various kind of signifiers of cowness. Right? So what Jnana Sriramitra is now saying is that words express objects on the basis of an appearance. And now we're getting closer to Nyaga's theory, right? This is inference. Right? We have a positive image that is not like any cow that actually exists, that signifies all other cows. Right? And that's what words express. This ground for determination is the vikalpa, this image of all particulars. And then he argues, well, but if you actually look at it, words express nothing whatsoever. Rather than really expressing objects on the basis of an appearance. Well, these mental images, nobody actually thinks that these mental images, these vikalpas, are what's expressed by words. He defeated that thesis earlier. Right? It would be utterly useless and also impossible to express a mental image through words. What words are expressing are external objects that aren't present to cognition, just external objects as empty placeholders in thought that we are working toward through practices of exclusion. So I want to talk a bit about how exclusion features in Jnana Sriramitra's philosophy of language. And again, his use of viavastas, his use of conditionally adopted positions. Are we doing okay with time, Tim?
Yes.
Okay, great. Okay, so he puts forward positions that, in the context of his debate, initially seemed quite conservative and acceptable and plausible, and then he progressively tears them apart and walks his opponent to the more absurd, ridiculous-sounding conclusion that nothing at all is expressed through words. It's this style of philosophizing. So his first thesis is that exclusion is just one property among many properties that objects have. So it's an element of being aware of an object. So the first thesis is that, you know, when we come to know a thing, such as a cow, right, we know that its character is qualified by certain properties, such as being a cow, right, maybe having a tail, maybe, depending on the kind of cow, having horns, right? Now, among these various properties that qualify cow in our understanding is the fact that it's different from things that are not cow. So when we understand or we come to know the moon, we come to know that it's bright. At the same time that we come to know the moon, we come to know that it's different from things that are not moon. We come to know its distinction from non-moons, such as the sun. Now, this is a necessary element of any cognition of an object. There must be this exclusion within it. If not, if you didn't know the difference, the distinction, you were able to exclude non-moons from moon, you might as well, you'd point up to the sky and think that the sun was the moon. You'd make mistakes. So the first thesis is that exclusion is just a property among many properties. And this is a position that's extremely palatable and friendly to the Purvapaksha, Dinyaga's imagined opponent. Now, the next thesis is a little bit more radical, but again, highly, highly plausible and not very challenging. Like, who would deny that, of course, you know, to know a thing is to know what it's not. That's part of knowing it. Right? That's not a radical thesis. The next thesis is maybe a little more radical, but not much. In conceptual awareness, he says, a single image appears. Remember, this is a vikalpa, the image that signifies all individuals. And that image represents all individuals intended by the concept. Exclusion helps to determine which individuals those are. So when I hear a word such as cow, based on my karmic history and my upbringing, I have an image, a stereotype of a cow. And exclusion features as an aspect of that stereotype or image. Right? So when I have a cow, I know, just on the basis of this image, that I would be shocked to discover something horse-like as a cow. Right? When I understand the moon, I would be shocked to understand something sun-like as the moon. So exclusion features in these positive images, these stereotypes that arise when we understand words. Right? And then these exclusions help us in our determining, our figuring out what words signify. So the process of figuring out the significance of a signifier, the significance of a word, is excluding this exclusion that's an element of the stereotype, the vikulpa, the image that arises within our mind when a word is uttered. He then proceeds, after establishing this position, to advocate a different thesis. Again, leading the opponent by the hand to a progressively more radical position. Exclusion not only necessarily qualifies the determination of an object on the basis of appearance, Jnanasri Mitra said, but really, exclusion is the only way any object is determined. Now we're starting to get into a more radical position. And we'll talk about how he justifies this thesis in a little bit. But just to make it a little bit more intelligible, right? How do you come to know a thing? It's not so much that you know it by grasping it, right? Say you have a soda in your fridge. You get up off of your couch and you decide you want to get a soda. Now, you know the soda at the time that you get up. You know, there's an inference happening. Right? You can't visualize the specific vivid soda in your fridge at the time that you're still on the couch. So what do? In order to get the soda? You get up and you act, and you don't have the particular can in front of your mind. What you have is assumptions, practices of what would not satisfy your thirst at a particular moment. Right? So you would not reach for the yogurt. You would not reach for the Kool-Aid, right? You would reach, you're reaching for the soda involves basically just not reaching for other stuff. That's what it means for you to get to your object. So exclusion is, again, according to Jnaga, it's now just not just a way of helping to determine. He's saying this is the sole way of figuring it out. When you get an object, when you come to know an object, you do it through exclusion, through recognition, aversion to what is not your desired object. His fourth and final thesis, then, is that the determined object and the exclusion that qualifies that determined object differ in name alone. No object is really expressed by words, since all we have are practices of exclusion that, when we judge well, end with a cessation of the thirst that propels the excluding. So we never run into the enduring Coke can, right? We never run into that object. What we have are immediate sensing. You've got the taste of the coldness, the touch of the coldness. You've got the taste of the soda, which is vivid, momentary, specific. You never actually run into, in your experience, an enduring Coke. All you have is experience, sensing. So no object is really expressed by words. No determined object, enduring object, is really expressed by words. Since all we have are practices of exclusion that hopefully help to seize the thirst that is propelling our action in the first place. Further, it would be useless or impossible for words to express mental images. Number one, that's not what people mean to express. When I say fire, I want to alert your attention to the fire. I don't want to alert your attention to your mental image of fire or my mental image of fire. Moreover, mental images can't be expressed through words since they're momentary, vivid, unique. So therefore, given that the only two options kinds of objects there are swalakshanas and smanyalakshanas, unique, momentary, particulars, and generic, enduring objects. And given that words can express neither of these, words express nothing whatsoever. All we have are habits, practices of determination that are guided by habits, practices of exclusion of the other. So before going on to assess this thesis, I want to highlight a little bit from the primary text. I get a little chuckle out of this, because I think it is a good way of explaining how Jnana Sri Mitra thinks that exclusion works in the determining of objects and the understanding of words. He takes this really mundane example. This road goes to Shrikna. So exclusion is the whole point of language use, even in the sentence, this road goes to Shrikna. This principle is easily satisfied. And he shows how the principle is satisfied through a kind of analytic approach, that is breaking, looking at each of the grammatical parts of the sentence and showing how exclusion works in the determination of the significance of the reference of each of those parts. This road goes to Shrikna. Now, this, say I'm pointing and I say, hey, this road goes to Des Moines, right? I know what I'm pointing to, not because I've got laser-like fingers that can specify exactly what I mean, but just because when you see me point, or when I see you point, I understand what you're not pointing at, right? I know that you're not pointing just a foot away from you, but rather it's about 30 feet, right? How do I know 30 feet? Well, I know that you're not pointing all the way over the hill. Right? I make assumptions about what you're not pointing at in order to understand the meaning of this. To Shrugna. Now, the meaning of Shrugna is nothing other than things that aren't Shrugna, specifically places, according to Jnana Sri Mitra. Right? So I know that this road goes to Des Moines because I know that it doesn't go... Sorry, my geography up here is horrible. Right? I know that it doesn't go to Chicago, right? I know that it doesn't go to Minneapolis, right? And it's by understanding where roads don't go that I understand what it means to go to Des Moines. Why? Well, there's loads of heterogeneous different ways of going to Des Moines. I'm not interested in enumerating which those are. I'm just interested in avoiding roads that are not going to take me to my destination. And that's how, according to Jnana Sri Mitra, all understanding works. And then he continues on. You understand the meaning of going. You understand the meaning of road. All by comprehending stuff that is not signified by these terms. So determination of the meanings of words operates through exclusion. These practices of exclusion present nothing enduring, objective to our attention. All we have are practices of exclusion. Given that these practices of exclusion don't bring any objects to our attention, nothing whatsoever is expressed by words. Universal ineffability. All right, so you might have noticed that in my the opening page, and then also in the poster, if you could see it, for this talk, I've got this recurring image here, and it's a postcard or photo by Barbara Kruger. Now, part of the reason I've got it is just I really love this piece of art, but also because I want to assess Jnana Sri Mitra's Apoha theory of language from the perspective both of this theory of philosophy that I've been kind of like toying with as the need to critique conventional norms, values, practices, while at the same time remaining engaged in the world. The other reason I want to do it is because I think that I want to assess Jnana Sri Mitra's philosophy specifically with respect to gender. And as Leah mentioned, this is another of my areas of focus, feminist philosophy and theories of gender. All right, so I want to apply Jnana Sri Mitra's philosophy of language and his exclusion theory of meaning to understandings of things like varna, right? One of the categories that the Buddha appears to have initially been looking to problematize. But I also want to look at it in terms of contemporary concepts such as gender, as well as conventional truth. Did I just break that?
No, it's fine.
Okay, great. Okay, so one place to start here is on what grounds are some conditionally adopted positions more efficacious than others, given that words express nothing whatsoever? So on what grounds, given that ultimate reality, really everything, is inexpressible beyond words, on what grounds can some conditionally adopted positions be more efficacious than others? Now, Let's look specifically at notions of varna, you know, Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra. Let's also look at notions of gender, male, female, and narrow the twain shall meet, right? So this binary system of gender classification. If we think that things correspond to these categories, then we're going to be inclined to think that they're already established, that they present something specific and meaningful to our understanding. Same thing with conventional truth. If we think of ordinary people's understanding, what normal people understand and believe, we can think that that's a given, that's already present to our thoughts, and we can imbue that notion of the given norm with all sorts of power. Right? Now, if we do that, if we think that things correspond to these categories, that things are expressed through these categories, then we're inclined to think that they're already established, and as a result, we ignore the practices of exclusion that Jnana Srimitra and other Apoha theorists are required continually to constitute and to reconstitute these categories. So, for instance, you might disassociate caste-related violence from the formation of caste categories in contemporary South Asia. You might ignore violence in, say, nation states, particularly anti-immigrant violence or anti-minority violence, ethnically loaded violence. You might disassociate that violence from the formation, the constitution of categories such as nation states. Similarly with gender. If we think that these are already established, then we can ignore the violences, the avoidances of certain kinds of touching, the punishment hit on people who fail to make those avoidances. We can overlook the practices of exclusion, of marginalization, that attach themselves to people who don't fit in that binary system of gender and sex. And likewise with conventional truth. If we think that conventional truths, normal understandings are already established and are normative, then you might say we lose the capacity for philosophy. We lose the capacity, we start thinking that abnormal, unconventional statements, references, are themselves suspect, rather than thinking that the suspectness of the abnormal, the marginal, is precisely what makes notions of the normal and the ordinary seem established. Now, conversely, if we think that things correspond to if we attend to the emptiness of these categories, categories such as caste, and I said varna. Varna is different from caste, right, but associated. But categories such as caste in contemporary context, categories such as gender, categories such as the normal, the ordinary. If we recognize, as Jnana Srimitra and other Apoha theorists want us to, right, that these categories are empty, that they don't present anything to consciousness, that these expressions don't present any objects or express any objects whatsoever, then we may perhaps be more likely to attend to question the appropriateness of practices of exclusion that determine some certain categories. Right? So if we think that notions like caste are not already established, then we might start thinking of caste-related violences as ways of constituting caste itself, as opposed to just being a peripheral thing. If we think of gender, of female, male, as empty categories, then we might think in terms of operations on intersex infants, of violences against trans and gender non-conforming people, as tactics of constructing, of creating these categories, practices of exclusion that are needed to seem to present objects to our thought. So if we attend to their emptiness, we're perhaps more likely to question the appropriateness of practices of exclusion that determine some certain categories. All right. Now, I raised the question initially, how in the world, on this theory, can some notions of conventional truth be more practically efficacious or better, less benighted, less ignorant, than other notions of conventional truth? Obviously, all conventional truths are truths. Right? So they're all flawed in a sense. Now, how to distinguish the gradations of truths, given that they all ultimately fail? Well, one thing that I want to raise is that there are certain kinds of knowing where practices of exclusion lead us on a path that eventually quench our thirst. I seek to go to Shrukna, I seek to go to Atlanta, I never have any object presented to my thought, it's always a kind of flawed way of knowing, but I get to my destination. The unsatisfactoriness, the thirsting that motivated my effort ceases as soon as I arrive at my destination. I no longer desire more, right? Now, certain ways of knowing are, on a conventional level, are practically efficacious in this way. But when you look at the constitution of social identity categories, such as caste, nation, gender, ethnicity, and so on, it could be the case that these categories are constituted, but the thirst to constitute the category never eliminates, disappears. All we have are continual practices of exclusion of the other. And so this is one way that I think that Shinyana Sri Mitra's project allows us to both critique conventional norms while engaging within and debating in possibly infuriating ways with others in society. Thank you.
We have time for some questions.
Yep.
So 15 minutes or so, I think. Leah.
Thank you, Father. I have to say, I kind of got chilled at that one important image, the idea of the intersect, intimate, not even appear in my mind as an object of thought, and the whole practice of illusion, very the actual violence of sense of thought, right? To tear it down, to see what it's not.
The construction of the unimaginable, that's interesting. Yeah.
But anyway, I'm not going to ask you about that image specifically, though, but I want to ask you a question I've already asked you before, that right now that's kind of work. I know that in other parts of the world, we criticize questions of the use of the language specifically in the English language research for scholarship, and so can you just talk a little bit about how this work is a background or a way of seeing that will cognitize other components of speech?
Yeah, no, I'm really glad for that question because it relates a lot. But it's a little bit shop talk too, right? But the way that it relates is there are a lot of folks right now that interpret specifically Chandrakirti, other Madhyamaka philosophers, and appeals to Loka Samrita Satya, Loka Via Vihara, in ways that draw comparisons or make analogies between Chandrakirti's and Madhyamaka Buddhist philosophies of language, Jnana Sri Mitra's philosophy of language, and the philosophies of pragmatist theories of language, specifically W.V.O. Quine, as well as other pragmatic theories of truth. Right? Now, I personally think that that's horribly problematic. Right? And that's one of the reasons that in Jnana Sri Mitra's notion of conventional truth, I've been highlighting that conventional truths don't need, they occur in gradations. You don't have ultimate truth, conventional truth, where conventional truth is a homogeneous whole. That, I think, comprehending that would be extremely problematic given these philosophies of language. You have these kind of continual practices of exclusion that can never be satisfied. But if you think of conventional truths as basically the thoughts and views of people in the world, and think of these people in the world as specifically embodied persons rather than generic signifiers of humanity, say, or of a society, then they can operate in a, I think, very rhetorically effective fashion. What is a conventional truth? It's not just things that that are widespread within a culture, right? So contemporary Americans believe in a binary gender system. You know, that would be a kind of conventional truth. It's a hegemonic view, a hegemonic belief. In Vedic India, Vedic South Asia, folks believe, folks in the world believe in a fourfold Varna system, right? That would be assigning a view to a whole culture. It'd be a hegemonic, a powerful view. But I think that with Jnana Sri Mitchard's view, unpopular views, such as the aliens abducted me on the deserted road at night, right? That could be conventionally true in the context of an engagement. So in the context of a discussion, a debate, an argument, things can be appear as conditionally adopted positions. Basically, you work with the views that people have, the specific views that specific people have in a context of discussion. And the goal, if you're Jnana Sri Mitra, is to lead them to the inside of the middle way.
I'm useless here. Immediate access.
Lorraine, yeah? Lenore, sorry. Yeah.
I have a really short time. And the comment is how exciting for watching. Especially because it so reminded me about the same kind of dichotomy in visual art that artists are always, well not always, but many artists try to critique culture by creating objects for them to become commodities within culture. And even more regarding part of the capital system so that we want to get outside and then inside and so that gave me another way to start. My question is about this empty house and whether there are different one empty house or any empty house. Because when you were talking about this future, this idea of the future, and the example of the refrigerator and one.
I really wanted a beer, I just didn't think it would be appropriate.
It seems like there's a lot more objects coming up by all the things you're excluding. So my first question is, don't you then have to know something positive about those exclusive things? And I mean, the way it was presented is, we know those, and we don't want them, but we only don't know what it is we want. And so that was one question. And the other question was related to the kind of the way we handle it, talking about gender and most categories, and the constant refilling. Seems really beautiful and important to me, but very, very different than emptying out the whole bottle and not knowing what that. And in this short time, I can't quite put my finger on why all these three ways of emptying out or eating seem so very different.
No, I think that's great. So I want to definitely get back to your first question, because what you've just expressed is one of the classical objections within the literature to these apoha theories. Right? So why is it less problematic to know non-moons than it is to just know the moon? Right? Don't I need to know positive things in order to do this excluding in the first place? So I definitely want to come back to that. In terms of the social identity stuff at the end, I do think that you're right that there seems to be an intuitive difference between knowing things like pots and cows and knowing social identity categories. I'm not sure how much, if we kind of dig beneath the surface, these are separate. The examples that are typically used in the text are things like pots and cows, right? And this goes back to Dinyaga, pots, cows, moons. But the kinds of categories that are often challenged within Buddhist philosophy and Buddhism are things like self, identity. Right? So I think that while explaining these theories in the context of cows, which may be code for Brahman, right? Elaborating it in terms of like cows and pots and so on, I think I imagine that the target are things like Atman, right? Which immediately, you know, self. Right, which immediately, to my mind, brings into notions of contemporary social identity categories like class, gender, caste, and so on. Right. Now, in terms of your question, that's the first question. The Buddhist opponents, that was their first and immediate reaction. And in seminars on Apoha and Buddhist philosophies of language, this is one of the first criticisms, most frequently voiced criticisms, and enduring criticisms that students and professors raise in class, right? That's okay. Right? You see the Buddha, kill him. So here's how I kind of make sense of it. Because, I mean, I got to say, I don't personally find much force in that argument, although a lot of other folks do. And some people I very much respect find it to be a decisive blow against the Poha theories of meaning. The reason I don't find it is because I think of these practices of exclusion at the phenomenal level. Right? So I never have an object in front of my mind, whether it's yogurt, whether it's beer, whether it's a Coke. Right? What I have are phenomenal processes, five heaps, interdependent heaps of phenomenal processes. I have actions and reactions that arise in the world of sensory presentation, in the world of feelings, in terms of my intellectual reactions to these feelings, in terms of my volition, my will, and then the types of memories that I store, right? And so this is really what's happening on the level, and its exclusion is operating at the level of the five skandhas, the five heaps of phenomenal processes, right? So these are, we figure things out not by identifying the milk, concluding the milk is not a beer, and pushing the milk aside. Rather, the identifying of the milk is that's determining for exclusion as well. We never have milk in front of our eyes. The doctor, I'm sure, would tell us that, you know, how our eyes operate, how cognition through sensing works, right? There are, you know, in our kind of contemporary parlance, there's waves that strike our irises, right, that produce particular kinds of cognitions. Sensing perception isn't a matter of seeing objects. Sensing is a matter of immediate, I don't want to say direct or immediate, but it's a matter of sensing a particular sense. Does that, and exclusion operates there. Great question. Right? So I think we have an idea of words recurring throughout language. Right? And I think in the same way that folks like Vinyaga and Dharmakirti would critique notions of enduring objects, they would also critique notions of enduring words. Right. In fact, when you hear them talk about how words are understood, and this is in Vinyaga's text, but also in Dharmakirti's and others, they break it down to the level of syllables. Right. So we have this sequence of sounds that break our cognition, and on the basis of our karmic histories, our upbringings, our practices, our habits, again, this is the level of the phenomenal processes, we are provoked, especially if we're not discipline. We are provoked to respond in particular kinds of ways. Right? Now this responding is going to involve practices of exclusion. Even with words. Right? So what I really hear, you could maybe map on a sensogram those things exist. An intellectual. This one? Oh,
what is the
I didn't say meaningless. I said ineffable. Right? And I think that this is one of these distinctions. Now, I think undefinability is something that is a bit more manageable than meaningless. Right? But the objection that you've raised is, again, an objection that's raised in the literature quite often, specifically against folks who endorse the Shunyata thesis, the thesis that everything is empty. Right? Well, the first objection, well, why in the world should I listen to you? Right? How am I understanding you? Right? I think, though, that undefinability or the ineffability is a little more manageable. Because part of the argument from Vinyaga that I didn't get to show, they show that if objects, or that if words did actually present objects to our thought, language would not work. Right? Language works precisely because it doesn't present objects to our thought. It allows us to it allows us to form, I guess, more pliable cognition. Right? So I hear that there's a house on Elm Street. Right? Through knowing the house on Elm Street, if I had an object presented to my thought, well, I would presumably know everything about that object. Right? If I had an object presented to thought, it would be very difficult to explain how I was ignorant of certain kinds of things. But it's only because there's a certain kind of opacity to reference, right? Language works. So when I hear, I'm told that there is a house on Elm Street. From the understanding of a house, I know that it's not a cave. I know that it's not these other things. I have a broad understanding of a heterogeneous set of things that could potentially satisfy that reference, which allows me, with various kinds of presentations, to be satisfied by many. So language works because of it, because it can signify heterogeneous, different kinds of particulars. Right? So it's the lack of definability, it's the lack of precision in a notion of intellectual ethnicity that allows it to be transcultural and transhistorical. It's precisely because it's not overdefined that intellectual ethnicity, the philosophizing, can be a non-Western specific practice.
Okay. So very fine. Well, that will be important to me. For me, I found it easy to accept this. It's in the goal. Yes, I believe. That's what I think about this goal is very.
Well, couldn't there just be practices? I think if you're with gender, why can't there just be practices of disciplining? Why can't there just be practices of exerting power? Right? And I think that a lot of post-structuralist theorists, when they interpret gender, that's what's happening. Right? How are categories of gender presented? Well, it's heterogeneous. It's supposed to persist across cultures and states. But how is it constituted into apparently specific categories? What about just exertion of power, where certain folks are pathologized, excluded from society, forcibly operated on, where certain people, isn't that just, aren't these practices of exclusion precisely what constitutes a category?
But I think they're operating inside the dichotomy so that and have a better life. Those that are different have the conventional wisdom, a great conventional norm. And if what you're saying is correct, that dichotomy shouldn't exist. It's not real.
Well, this is where I think that this notion of the conditionally adaptive positions, and also, the Just because something is real and ultimately fictional doesn't mean that it doesn't exist for us. Right? So Dinyaga is not saying that we don't understand things through words. Right? Well, he is technically saying we don't understand things through words, but he's not saying that words are practically inefficacious. Rather, he elaborates a theory of how words are efficacious. They're not efficacious by presenting things to cognition. Rather, they are efficacious through practices of exclusion that result in a cessation of thirst that provokes the action. Right? And so words do have power. Words like conventional truth, conventional understanding, they do have power. The question is, do they exert a kind of power that ought to be critiqued, that ought to continue, or do they not? If they're practically efficacious, if they result in the cessation of the thirst that propels the conceptualizing in the first place, then they're practically efficacious. I would argue that ideas like self, identity, are not practically efficacious, and they can't be. We'd be better off directing our attention to the cultivating of specific, lucid habits of thinking, acting, feeling. Right? I would argue that. But there are some ways of using words that are practically efficacious. I tell you, how to get to the airport, right? You're motivated to get to the airport. That causes you to ask the question. That affects how you interpret the question, the answer. And then your thirst for getting to the airport ceases when you encounter appropriate svalakshana, unique, real, particular. So language can be practically efficacious.
Yeah. When we were talking about how we language and that the problem in the interpersonal communication is the product of
That's interesting. It's interesting because Dinyaga's section where he introduces a poha is on a section where he talks about inference for others. Right? So that would seem to suggest that it is a kind of, this is a kind of inferring that happens in the context of interpersonal discussion. But if you break it down like that, inferring for others in the text doesn't seem to be tied specifically to dialogue with others. I personally think of it in terms of how anybody thinks about a thing. Right? It's not through presentation of an object of thought. Rather, it's through assumptions about what it will, won't do, what you expect, what you don't expect about it. Right? Part of my understanding of this podium is that I'm not going to fall through it. Right? So that's how these ideas are constituted for myself, and also I would say for others. Yeah, we're still using language. I guess one reason I'd want to hold on to the notion of exclusion with even in understanding words to ourselves and not just speaking is because, at least in my own experience, I've made a hell of a lot of mistakes, right, in my conceptual thinking, right? And how are those mistakes made? I would think that they operate in the same way, right? So, before moving to Sri Lanka, before moving to India, I had a lot of very Orientalist imagery in my mind about these locations. Right? And I think it was the kind of stereotypes, the vikalpas, that I had in my mind in that context. That's really interesting. I'm not a Buddhist practitioner, right? And so my meditative experience is really quite limited and very novice level, right? But I have read, things like the Satipatthana, where they talk about practices to cultivate mindfulness and that sort of thing. And on my kind of immediate recollection, I'm not familiar with practices that focus specifically on words. right? But it's an element, you know, verbal understandings are going to be an element of the five keeps, and so they could be an appropriate object of contemplation, right? I do think that the practices of exclusion are clearly within the five keeps, skandhas of experience, and would be related with affection, will, intentions, and so the linguistic elements could be very useful. Maybe somebody who's actually a practitioner would have a better answer to that.
But in the text,
it's fascinating. In the text that we're working on, they have they apparently have no apparent obvious connection to Buddhist practice. Right? These are highly philosophical texts. It's not even clear. You know, you find very few references to soteriological ends within these texts. You know, it's one of the reasons that these texts have been highlighted is because people wanted to wrestle Indian philosophies away from the kind of label of mysticism and so on. And these are hardcore analytic texts. Yeah, absolutely. Right, so I mean there are the kind of customary orations and recognitions beforehand, and there are, you know, honorifics thrown in, but there doesn't appear to, there's no explicit connection with soteriology in the Samana Samuchaya and or in the Apoha Prakarana. Please start.
And maybe this is completely a wrong idea, but I was thinking about what that would be like to know something like
mm-hmm.
categories that are at, like we're talking about gender status a lot. It seems that it takes the word from being a noun into being a topic. And so when you don't see it as a topic, you can see it as
yeah, I think you're absolutely right, and that's one of the things that I like it, right? It's a kind of like, you know, and there's a kind of orientation to process is very much in, you know, it's a recurring theme in a lot of Buddhism, Buddhist philosophy, and I do think that what's happening here is we want to move away from thinking about the significance of words as objects and think more about this, the processes of comprehending and understanding or misunderstanding the term. And it's that shift and partially why they can tolerate this ineffability. Yeah, I think you're totally right.
What quenched your thirst in the case of the statement that was from off? Can we talk about the real?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, what, you know, there's a notion of sublation, right? So bad cognition, and this isn't just in Buddhist, but also in Nyaya and other traditions, Mimamsa, Advaita, right? Bad beliefs, cognitions are sublated, right? So you have a correcting cognition that arises, and when that correcting cognition arises, the other one just vanishes, right? So, and that's how correction works. So usually it's perceptual knowledges that sublate inferential and verbal knowledges within the tradition. All right, so yeah, a kind of direct awareness, and I don't believe an unmediated experience, but you know, living in an area, like living in Hawaii for a long time, bad assumptions about these places and cultures and societies just disappear. And less, hopefully less distorting and in some context dangerous ones disappear. Right, similarly with capitalism, right? You know, belief in kind of like neoliberal development projects, you know, even when very entrenched, can, when exposed to the right kinds of phenomena and text, can just simply disappear. You can't believe what you used to believe anymore. You can't live like you used to live anymore. So does that answer your...
Does the signal connection to pragmatism early first,
yeah,
and later, but just to be clear, perception working in an unmediated fashion for all these colors?
It's true perception, pratyaksha, is at the ultimate reality level, immediate, unmediated, direct, unified grasping. But when you talk about the perception of conventional things in Jnanasri Mitra and in Dharmakirti, that's going to become inferential as well, right? So we come to know, perceive, right, things like cows and chairs through the same processes. Right, absolutely.
I think all this suggests one thing that we suggest to consider when it comes to the point that the own practices are breathing. What are the grounds of the practices?
Well, I don't think you necessarily have to stand on a thesis or an ideology. One of the things I like about Jnanasri Mitra is his possibly annoying flexibility. He seems pretty willing to put his flag, at least temporarily, on pretty much any thesis. And he doesn't seem to land anywhere constant either. He's a tremendously flexible thinker, which I like. I do think, though, and because these connections are not explicit in the text, it's highly speculative. But personally, I find the lesson of the Folha theories of meaning, exclusion theories of meaning, to be a refocusing, a redirecting of attention from questions of ontology, metaphysics, epistemology, language, to ethics. And I think that fits within Buddhist philosophy in general, the continual refocus to ethical practice, which I personally like.
Thanks, Professor Gagne. And some really thoughtful questions from you all as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Doing it again in
3-4 weeks?
24, that's 3 weeks. Yeah. Ineffability in art.